Welcome. This is Allison Bailey, and I'll be your host today on this special edition of Practice Made Perfect. As the COVID-19 pandemic continues worldwide, we've decided to add additional podcast content focused on this emergency and what's important for our cardiovascular team to know now. I'm very excited to host representatives from the geriatric cardiology section today, as we know that geriatric cardiology has come to the forefront during this time of COVID-19 because of the adverse outcomes associated with both advancing age and pre-existing cardiovascular disease in our patients. The geriatric cardiology section serves as a professional home for ACC members who focus on the care of older adults with cardiovascular disease and will discuss topics of particular interest to our older population in the time of COVID. I'm happy to welcome Dr. James Kirkpatrick, who's the director of the Echocardiography Lab at the University of Washington Medical Center, as well as one of the few ethics-trained cardiologists in the United States. He lectures and performs research in the areas of ethics and cardiac devices and palliative cardiology, and serves as the chair of the Geriatric Cardiology Council. Welcome, Jim.
Well, very glad to be here, Allison. Thanks for the invitation.
You're very welcome. Next up, we have Dr. Nicole Orr. Dr. Orr is an assistant professor in the Division of Cardiology at Tufts University School of Medicine and the founder and president of Post-Acute Cardiology Care. She serves both as a staff cardiologist and consultant to skilled nursing facilities in the Northeast region and provides weekly bedside rounds for high-risk residents with cardiovascular disease. Welcome to the show, Nicole.
Hi, Allison. Thanks so much for having me.
And last, but certainly not least, is Dr. Matt Maurer. Dr. Maurer is the Arnold and Arlene Professor of Cardiology and Professor of Medicine at Columbia University Irving Medical Center. He directs the Clinical Cardiovascular Research Laboratory for the Elderly at New York Presbyterian Hospital, Columbia University Medical Center. He is a general internist and geriatric cardiologist with advanced training in heart failure. His research focuses on cardiovascular changes in older patients. Welcome, Matt.
Great to be here and pleasure to be with you and Nicole and Jim.
Nicole, I know we've all seen in the news about the devastating effects COVID can have in skilled nursing and long-term care facilities, and I know this is an area you work closely in. Can you share more information about this?
Sure. Thanks, Allison. Yeah, so there's been a lot of discussion about the devastating effects of COVID-19 outbreaks in long-term care. I can speak from my experience rounding in skilled facilities in the Northeast region that, yes, it has been devastating. For listeners who might not be familiar with the landscape and the terms long-term care, skilled nursing, post-acute care, nursing homes can offer both long-term care and subacute rehab. Long-term care is for residents who can't care for themselves at home or in assisted living. And subacute care is for patients who require skilled nursing or physical therapy. And that's where a lot of our cardiac patients go after a hospitalization for a cardiac event or a procedure for recovery. So nursing homes can offer both services, and we've heard there's been a lot of press. In fact, the Wall Street Journal last week reported the number of COVID-19 deaths in long-term care facilities to be over 10,000 patients, and that is a huge number, but I would venture to say it's even larger than that. For one, that was only data from 35 states, and sadly, so many patients are dying quickly, the workup for COVID-19 isn't even completed before they've passed. So I think the first outbreak that we heard that set the stage about how severe the crisis was going to hit long-term care was in the Kirkland Nursing Home in Washington. And that was, you know, really remarkable, not only for the quick spread of the virus among residents, but it confirmed the data we already discussed that, you know, patients with multiple comorbidities who are older, which is the demographic in these facilities, the mortality rate is just much higher. And, you know, that was back in February, prior to nursing homes having the ability to implement recommended safeguarding measures. So there was some discussion that what happened in Kirkland might have been because of lack of preparation. However, in the last 2 months, we've seen with all of the recommendations following CDC guidelines, implementing safeguarding measures, which include limiting visitors, screening all staff for symptoms and fevers, limiting vendors, limiting egress and entrance ways. Despite that, we are still seeing devastatingly high mortality rates and rapid spread of the virus among these facilities. And so, how are they dealing with it? I have to say, I think there are a lot of different factors at play. I think the most striking thing about the COVID pandemic affecting nursing homes right now is just how variable nursing homes are across the country. And I think that depends on a couple of things. So you won't find any two nursing homes that are dealing with this in the same way or that have the same number of cases or fatalities. I think it depends a lot on geography, staffing, and the system which it operates, and then the leadership of the nursing home. So facilities in surge areas, such as New York and Washington, where, you know, it happened so quickly, they were forced to engage in these safeguarding measures and disaster planning very quickly. They didn't have very much time to prepare. They've really been suffering from lack of protective equipment, lack of testing, lack of protocols for staff. Those who are in areas where they haven't seen surges, there are some very good stories. I think some facilities are really able to invest in resources to develop COVID units, stockpile PPE, ensure adequate testing, and develop some management protocols. But not all skilled nursing facilities have had that luxury. It came on too quickly. Staffing is a really, really big issue right now in this healthcare sector. And most facilities are actually operating under significant staffing shortages right now. So in some in the Massachusetts area have reported that they're operating at 40% of staffing capacity. So that's been really difficult. Staff are, you know, either falling ill to the virus or they're simply not coming because they're scared because they don't have adequate protection. And many are unfortunately just not showing up to work. And, you know, I think another problem is that SNFs are often functioning as freestanding silos, and they don't have the rich infrastructure that hospitals do to develop disaster management teams or protocols. They don't have reserves, financial reserves, or staffing reserves to tap into. So they'll fare differently depending on the systems in which they operate. So SNFs with robust relationships with hospitals or home care agencies might fare better if they can share protocols, resources, collaborate on transferring patients. But many are relying on, you know, directives from corporate headquarters, which is challenging because they're sort of dealing with multiple SNFs across the country, which are dealing with different surges and fatality rates. And finally, I think leadership among SNFs is critical, but unfortunately, there's a significant amount of regional administrative leadership burnout in high surge areas just because everything came on so suddenly. So then they're, you know, responsible for being on multiple calls with the Department of Public Health several times a day, adjusting plans multiple times a week depending on the number of cases, operating with bare bones staffing, suffering from lack of revenue as they rely on rehabilitating patients after elective procedures, which aren't being done. But there are some facilities as well that have great, strong leadership that are communicating with staff, emphasizing keeping up morale, using resources wisely, constantly thinking of backup plans, and some of them are doing okay. So I think, you know, right now, there are no two SNFs that are alike. The landscape is very heterogeneous, and so how they're faring really depends on a lot of different things.
Well, Nicole, you brought up so many great points that I honestly had never really thought about. You know, being a cardiologist, I obviously send a lot of patients to either rehab or, you know, skilled nursing facilities. And I can't even imagine trying to, you know, make everything go well there now, as challenging as it is. How, as cardiologists, can we help in this area? Do you have any advice or tips for us?
I think, importantly, is just being aware of the situation. And I think for cardiologists who are communicating with hospitalized COVID patients, letting them know they might not be able to get to a SNF and get the services they might need or expect after their hospitalization is important, because many providers and systems are actually trying to avoid sending patients to skilled nursing facilities now just because of the issues we discussed. And so just communicating to those patients that you might not have staffing to help you with recovery, you might have to go directly home, but we'll address that, we'll stay in touch, you know, we'll offer what we can potentially through home care, but letting them know that that option of skilled nursing facility might not be available. And one piece of advice for cardiologists that I would say is really important is that if there is a patient who is eligible to go to a skilled nursing facility, which largely means that they've recovered with negative testing, so they're no longer shedding the virus, if they are sent to a skilled nursing facility, I think cardiologists can help by understanding that every little bit of time that nurses can save on even something as simple as med pass time is really critical in the staffing shortage. So most of our cardiac patients are on a ton of medications, sometimes up to 9 or 10. And if cardiologists can maybe think about simplifying their regimen, so cutting down from BID to once daily dosing, potentially getting rid of medications that are unessential, or for primary prevention in older patients, cutting down 5 to 10 minutes on med pass time is actually going to be helpful. Finally, if there are some patients with cardiac issues who are residing in skilled nursing facilities, maybe prior to the outbreak or the surge, either recovering from a heart failure admission, a procedure, there's a lot of emphasis right now on utilization of telemedicine in skilled nursing facilities, and potentially the role of specialists will expand. I think right now, especially in a surge area, even the staff to engage in that telemedicine interface might be limited. So unless it's a really essential telemedicine visit, it's probably worth considering whether or not that even needs to be set up just to just help, you know, save on the resources from a staffing perspective, because the staff are really needed at the bedside. So anything sort of elective or non-essential at this point, especially in a surge area, should be deferred.
That's really great practical advice. And again, not something I would have thought about, just how overtaxed these facilities are and not having the time to do a visit.
So we talked about for our patients in any sort of post-acute care facility, it's not only a scary time because of the increased risk from COVID, but also from the isolation from family, friends, and loved ones. Matt, are there ways we can help improve the communication between families and caregivers when they can't be present at the hospital or at a post-acute care facility?
Yeah, I think there are many ways. I think it's important to emphasize that, you know, patients want to be still connected to their family members. Some basic things, don't forget to remind patients when they're coming for their acute care visit or going to a long-term care facility to bring chargers for their phones, because we've seen patients run out. In fact, we had a grant given from an institution to actually provide chargers, which was incredibly helpful. That's really their lifeline back to family members. Again, we've leveraged at our institution iPads on carousels in which you can, you know, interact with not only the patient, but the family members, and they get to see each other. And that's really a wonderful thing, especially, God forbid, in circumstances of intense critical illness. Learn that you can do multiple FaceTime chats because many family members want to get together and interact with the clinician. And it's a very stressful time. And so there are ways to essentially dial multiple numbers at once and bring the entire family together along with their providers. And the last thing that we've instituted at our place is what one of the house officers called caregiver rounds, and they want to carry it forward in the future. And that is to take a few minutes out of your day, usually both in the morning and in the evening, call the point person for the family and provide an update rather than them trying to track you down and find out what's going on with their loved one. As I think many people are probably aware, unfortunately, in the era of the COVID pandemic, the first thing that the hospital does to mitigate, you know, against the spread of the virus is to not allow visitation and visitors, not just, you know, quote unquote, in ICUs, but throughout the hospital. And so social isolation really becomes a major issue. And those are some of the strategies you can mitigate against it.
Okay, great. I really love that caregiver rounds. I'm sure the families appreciate that well, and what a great way to teach communication to some of our house staff and younger physicians. Jim, what do you think the role is for telemedicine in addressing the social isolation that we were talking about during this challenging time?
Oh, I would agree with Matt absolutely that telehealth has a major role in this pandemic, and we're very fortunate actually to live in this time in which we do have telehealth opportunities for people to connect with loved ones, to actually see them, to use multiple different platforms that are available to reduce the social isolation. But you know what? We have to think about it first. We have to realize that there are elderly people, patients, relatives, others who are basically confined at this point and are very lonely. And I think it's all of us, not just as healthcare providers, but really as human beings, need to take on some of that as our way of reducing the isolation. My daughter was off of school, and she started making cards, and she's made lots and lots of cards, got her friends to do it, and she basically has provided them both thank you cards to healthcare workers, but also to patients in the hospital, not just patients with COVID, but others who are really needing a little brightening to their day. I think there's so many different ways to do this. And as Nicole said, it's not just about the patients who are in the hospital. It's about those who are closed off from the world in some ways in these extended care facilities. And I think we all need to redouble our efforts to try to reduce that social isolation.
Yeah, I think that's really great advice. And those little acts of kindness really go a long way in these closed environments that we're in, whether it's for the patients or for the staff and our colleagues. And I think we're all learning new ways to connect with people and connect people to each other during this time. I know you have a lot of experience in advanced care planning as well as palliative care. So what's the role of advanced care planning now during COVID?
That is a great question. And I would just basically say that COVID kind of highlights the need for palliative care and for advanced care planning that have always been there. There's not really anything particularly special about someone realizing that they could end up on a ventilator, unable to communicate, and in need of making some very difficult healthcare decisions. Because the reality is that could happen to any of us at any time. So I think that we need to look at it that way. And what I've been doing with my patients in the general cardiology clinic is at the end of the visit to ask them about their advanced directives, living will, durable power of attorney for healthcare. And oftentimes I have to define what that is because a lot of people think that's just in reference to their finances. And of course, right now they don't want to talk about that. But then talk about their desires and what they would want if they were in that situation. And they can relate because they hear a lot on the news about people who are in that situation and the poor family members who have to make tough decisions in some cases. And really, it's a gift of grace for people to have had those tough conversations ahead of time to lay out their values and what they want to achieve in life with the time that they've been allotted and what might actually be their decision if they were in that kind of situation. And then, of course, most importantly is appointing a surrogate decision maker with whom they've had those discussions. And really, I think that's what we need to start doing. We've actually had a palliative care nurse who is coming on to do that for our cardiovascular patients, and she is very, very skilled at it. And it really doesn't involve necessarily documenting something like a pulsed form or a physician order for limitation of life-sustaining treatment in the outpatient setting. We don't have to do that. That's not appropriate for a nurse who's making these calls to do. That really has to be done within conversation with someone's physician and clinician. But nonetheless, I think we can all do our part in bringing up these issues of exploration of values, goals, and preferences, and appointing, if one hasn't already, a surrogate decision maker, and really helping people to have the conversation. I think that will go a long way towards helping people really to deal with the tough times that may be ahead for them, whether it's during the COVID pandemic or it's at the end of their life at a different time.
Great. So maybe one of the things that will come out of this is that we'll have more realistic discussions about what we want at the end of life. I think that's a really good point. I also think it's great when a patient provider that they're familiar with can have that discussion with the patient when they're in a stable outpatient environment, not in an ICU. Can you do these sessions remotely?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I think that if you have been, especially if you've been able to establish that trusting relationship with someone, then you can have these difficult conversations and even conversations about actual orders for life-sustaining treatments. But I think you can also have these conversations even with someone, quote-unquote, cold calling, and that's essentially what our palliative care nurse is doing. We actually piloted this with patients with ventricular assist devices or being considered for ventricular assist devices, and we had a palliative care nurse talk to them. She'd never met them before and just went through some of these very basic explorations of what they would want, what their goals are, and who is the surrogate decision maker. Patients appreciated that, even though they really had no relationship with this nurse and were not going to talk to her again. But they were able to begin to start thinking about this. And then when the nurse communicated to the rest of the VAD team, they were so appreciative. And in some cases, this led to a full palliative care consult and some uncovering of some incredibly important things that were crucial to decision-making in regards to the VAD. I think we just have to start on this road in a greater way than we have in the past, if COVID is helping us to do that, that may be one very small bright thing that comes out of this. There's many, many more dark things. But I think we have to look for those bright things so we can celebrate and move forward in.
Okay, yeah, no, I agree with you completely. So much useful information has been shared about how to optimize care for our geriatric population during COVID. If we fast forward and get past the peak of the pandemic and look to the future, how do we return to our new normal? Nicole, what do you think that's going to be like?
Yeah, great question, Allison. I think, like in most aspects of healthcare, cardiologists caring for older adults have had some real eye-openers during this pandemic. I think it's going to make us more aware of the vulnerability of this population, even more so, and make us focus more on the utility of testing and interventions that we routinely do, and call to awareness more needs for goals of care discussions and, of course, advanced care planning. But more immediately, you know, in the next couple of months, as we start now discussing opening up labs or surgical services, we need to be very mindful of the impact on this particularly high-risk cohort. I think unless we have a vaccine or much more testing, even after surges might end in your particular practice area, older adults who have been sheltering in place and are not yet immune will remain vulnerable if exposed. So thinking very critically for the next possibly 6 months or longer about whether a procedure is going to significantly impact quality of life for older adults is critical. And of course, if a procedure needs to be done, which there will be situations where this applies, really thinking from start to finish about how to manage that patient, which will include finally orchestrating their care, which includes an appropriate recovery plan after the procedure. So if they can go home, plan ahead for the family to prepare for telemedicine follow-up visits. If the patient will need skilled nursing facilities that can't be offered at home through home care and they need to go to a SNF, it will be very important for the cardiology department and staff to work closely with case managers who may know the skilled nursing facility landscape and then discern which SNFs that are geographically feasible for the patient are prepared with adequate staffing, physical therapy services that aren't furloughed, that have appropriate safeguarding measures to accept and care for that vulnerable patient are going to be very important. So ideally, sending a COVID-negative patient to a COVID-naive SNF would be ideal, but we can't predict how many more SNFs will stay COVID-naive and when those that are affected will be cleared.
Okay, certainly a lot to think about for our geriatric population during this time and for the future.
Yeah, I think COVID actually has laid bare the need for geriatric cardiology. And there are several, I just want to highlight again, unique aspects of what that entails. It's really treatment that considers the whole person, in addition, obviously, to their cardiovascular circumstances. For patients, obviously, who have limited cardiovascular reserve and have multiple comorbidities. And so, you know, the applicability of, you know, simple clinical trials isn't so easy. We like to embrace patient-centered and evidence-based medicine. And I think we're going to focus a lot more in the future on outcomes that are relevant to older adults. And that is functional capacity and their ability to maintain their independence. So I think a lot of the skill sets that geriatric cardiology offers for providers is going to become ever more essential in the era of COVID.
In the heart failure world, we discuss that a lot with patients, no matter what their chronological age, as we discussed. And I think you're right. I think this is really going to shed a light on a lot of the choices that we make. Jim, how about you? Any thoughts or predictions about the future?
Well, I agree with everything that Nicole and Matt have said. I think they're spot on. In addition, I think that we will be doing a lot more telemedicine. That will certainly be in places where there's heavy traffic burdens and it's difficult for people to get into the office to be seen. And it will just make it much, much easier, especially for our older patients, to be able to have those telemedicine visits and phone visits that take the place of having to come in and sit in the waiting room and pay for parking and brave the traffic. So I think we all need to be prepared for that. We have to think of ways that we're going to do that. But again, as everybody's said already, it's going to be tough to figure out who should be seen that way and who needs to actually come in. We're going to have to develop some good and smart protocols for doing that. And we're going to have some bumps in the road as we work through that. But I think ultimately it's going to be more satisfying, and it's going to actually fulfill some of our patient reported outcomes that we really want to facilitate. And it's going to make everybody a bit happier in the end, I hope.
Okay, great. Thank all of you so much for such an informative podcast today, as we've talked about geriatric patients and specifically cardiology patients in the setting of COVID. I'm sure our listeners picked up a lot of tips regarding care delivery for our geriatric patients that transcends this current pandemic and hopefully can help improve the lives of our cardiac patients down the road. I'd like to thank all of our listeners and hope everyone is staying safe during this challenging time. Thank you.